Kia ora. This program is brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard.
Nau mai, haere mai. I'm John McDonald, kia ora, and welcome into the Community Drive Hut Zone on Thursday the 23rd of November. The Hut Zone is Wellington Access Radio's weekly look into the stories, history, people, poems and music that make the Hutt Valley community. Tonight we go out and trap vermin, rats, mice and hedgehogs with Korokoro Environment Group's Andre Oliver. We hear more in the 2019 history series on one of the Hutt's great health pioneers, Dame Cecily Pickerel, as we talk to local author of the book, A Dame We Knew, Beryl Harris. We have new poetry from Wanyamata's David Smith, The Language of Hugs. There's a story from a member of the Hutt City Writers Table Group, Tabitha Wood, An Ocean of Stars. And we hear loads of local music. The Drongos, Monkey Business, King Leo, Dogging Me Around, Shindig, King of the Fairies, and Will Martin, Going Home. So let's open the show with some Chopin, study in C major, played by Korokoro's Benjamin Carter. And that was Benjamin Carter playing Chopin's study in C major, being placed third in his age group at this year's Shuhai International Mozart Competition. Time for the poetry reading of the week, some empathetic prose from Wanumata's David Smith.
I'm Arlene Croft and I'm reading a poem by David Smith. It's called The Language of Hugs. If you want to learn another language, it is never too late to learn how to hug. As without knowing when to hug, how to hug, when not to hug, what message your hug is sending, and when it should be ending, it is hard to set the right tone for the use of other language. Once you have mastered the art of hugging, the results will not be disappointing. With less shrugging, with less shouting, with less pouting, with a lot less complaining, and hopefully with time, more forgiving.
And that was Trentham's Arlene Croft reading The Language of Hugs, written by David Smith. Time for the next part of the local history series on a pioneering plastic health practitioner, Dame Cecily Pickerel. In 2019, I met with local historian and writer Beryl Harris to hear about her book, A Dame We Knew.
After she graduated, she became house surgeon to Dr. Henry Percy Pickerel, who was the first dean of the dental school in Otago, a jaw surgeon to the Dunedin Public Hospital. Her story from then on is intertwined with his, as he did all her training. He was lucky enough to have been both trained medically and in dental surgery. And in 1909, he was a lot older than her, 25 years older than her, he was made the first dean of the dental school, and he made our whole dental service. In Dunedin, at that stage, the dental school was across the road from the public hospital, and they had very good connections that he was easy to work amongst both disciplines. He was born in Birmingham, and he left New Zealand for World War I to work with Harold Gillies, who is always recorded as New Zealand-born, but I'm going to say he was also UK-trained, ENT surgeon, ear, nose and throat, but he'd never worked in New Zealand, never. Gillies was very important to us because he was responsible, you know, like how we like to think they came from New Zealand. He was responsible for setting up the jaw and facial surgery unit. The number of facial injuries was so immense that they needed more personnel than just him. They had to have a New Zealand section, a Canadian section and an Oz section. And these were all set up within 12 months. So that was a big thing that Gillies did for the war. New Zealand's section of the facial unit at World War I was Pickerel. The two men were like chalk and cheese. Gillies, according to his daughter, was quite a buffoon. He liked to play like throw toilet rolls at the Duke of Edinburgh from the top of the stairs, a bit like the Dunedin people now. Mm-hmm. I didn't say that. And he invented the high tee for golf, which means a long bottle with a golf ball on top. Had it shattered, it would have been dangerous, very dangerous. But Gillies and Pickerel got on together, setting this this unit up. But Gillies took the UK unit and Pickerel took the New Zealand unit. As I said, his daughter said he was a buffoon, but Pickerel was a doer Englishman. They were like chalk and cheese. The books that have been written have noted the jealousy between the two men. I like to think that they're not jealous because they stayed friends. They were just totally into their work and they needed each other to succeed because both of them had knowledge. 6 months before the units were set up to receive all these poor men from the front. At the end of World War I, Pick and Giles, the two men, were called. And this is Cecily's history in the background. He wouldn't return to New Zealand until he was able to bring with him his New Zealand patients who had unfurnished surgery. To this end, the Red Cross and Dunedin Public Hospital came to the rescue and allowed a special hospital to take place up near the gardens. And I think, from what I read and understand, Cecily would have had access to these patients too, very early in her training, but as part of her training, they had to know about these things. Gillies never worked for New Zealand, but these two stayed friends. I think I've said that. Gillies being serious, but a bit of a clown at times, and Pickerel being a serious doer Englishman. They were opposites, but learning from each other, and that's important. They'd learnt from each other, and they did excellent work for their patients. So back in Dunedin, Cecily, who was still a student, in hearing of all the work that had been done, the war work, by one of her tutors at that stage, was then lucky enough to become his house surgeon for a year. This is Pickerel. He did make a comment that's the best house surgeon I ever had. I'd say because she was a woman and had small hands and she loved sewing. apparently the other men, when the results came out, whether they had passed or not, or got jobs as house surgeons, somebody passed her a card. She told me this herself. They passed her a card and says, here's one for you, Cecily. You like sewing. Go and do plastic surgery. So she applied and she got it. So she became his house surgeon, and that was the start of her total career. After her finishing her training, she went to America to see her family, where her father, from being an Anglican vicar at Taihape to an army chaplain to being in charge of an Episcopalian, that's a Catholic Anglican church in America. She did have work to go to, 6 months in a psychiatric hospital, which she totally disliked, intensely, she told me. Not like she was aware of in New Zealand, like Truby King, before he became Sir Truby, had this mental hospital at Seacliff in Otago, and she had experienced this while she was training. It was very much an outdoor life as compared to the Hollywood, California life that she spent in that psychiatric unit for 6 months. I can totally understand it because it came with my experience in neurosurgery. I loved being in the ward, but I hated being in theatre. However, in New Zealand at that time, it was almost impossible for a woman to practice medicine unless they had married another doctor or worked in the community somewhere, like their husband was a farmer, and they, they were able to work for the woman or the children. So contacting Dr. Pickerel, now working in Oz, that's Dr. HP, she was invited to be his assistant, his partner, and then they set up in business together as Pickerel and Clarkson. Now, the reason why Pickerel had gone to Australia was post-war, the dental school grew and his jaw surgery work also grew because of the experience. But together with his board, they argued bitterly against one particular facet, that having young women trained as dental nurses to tend the children's teeth. He thought it was much wiser to have dentists to attend to the children's teeth. I think you may know people with lots of amalgam in their teeth who have sometimes had to have them out. He was dead against this. He wanted trained dentists on the children's teeth. Not a bad ideal. But he lost his argument and he left for Oz, amongst other reasons. His family, wife and 4 children, was to go with him. He was all set to go with him, but at the last minute, having been farewelled by the community, they stayed in Otago. This was most upsetting for him. But 7 years later, he divorced his wife for her desertion. Not his desertion, but her. That was the rule, the law at that time. He was most upset and kept in touch with his children as much as he could, as much as he was allowed sometimes. In 1934, Cecily aged 31 and Pick aged 55, so he was no catch, married, and they returned to New Zealand because in Australia there was a recession and there was very little work. They had finished all the war work and they were more into cosmetic work over there. Cecily had now had many years training and work with Pick, and New Zealand benefited by this. First setting up in Wellington, then living in Silverstream, they both worked at plastic surgery in the Wellington Hospital, the Home of Compassion, and Lewisham. I think it's Lewisham, now Wakefield. They also took turns in travelling by the overnight train in the weekends to set up the beginnings of the plastic surgery for Middlemore Hospital. During the week, they left Dr. Brownlee, who's now quite famous too, as house surgeon. He cared for their clients. All this time, they began following a dream, first of establishing a hostel for mothers and babies to stay while they were having their repair work done in the main hospitals. The repairs were mostly hair lip and cleft palate, which until this time, many babies born with this malformation were kept in the background, were kept in the back blocks and not shown. Or they were operated on and they had some terrible results. But all this time, the besom, after being in a hostile state, the besom was now in full swing in the early 1940s.
I'm John McDonald, and you're in the Hut Zone on Wellington Access Radio 106.1 FM. And that was Beryl Harris talking on the pioneering life of Dame Cecily Pickerel. Part 3 plays next week. Time for more music. Here's Lower Hutt's Will Martin, Going Home.
Work hold on later.
And that was Lowerhut's Will Martin and Going Home. Time for a short story from a member of the Lowerhut Writers' Table.
An Ocean of Stars by Tabitha Wood. She drives to the beach every morning, come rain or wind or shine. She takes the book with her, wrapped carefully in a translucent sheath, to ensure no part of it can be damaged. It is special to her, this book, for reasons she can't always explain. The places described and the characters within, she can visualize them clearly. She knows them intimately and in great detail. The curve of the rocks and the shapes of the city are all familiar to her and have been for many years. She recognizes that secret place where the ocean inhales the land. She has walked the pathways through the back streets and the gardens, embracing all the colors painted in the palette of the earth. She has her favorite spots, her sacred spaces, damp seats curved and carved from driftwood, sandblasted by the sea wind as it churns and sways. She knows the whispers and the birdsong, the heartbeat of the land. All this the book knows too, and lends its wisdom through its pages. It speaks to her in words only she can understand. She sits at the edge of the harbour, perched on the low concrete wall which separates the busy road from the wild sea. The eager wind asks her to dance, but she declines politely. She takes a deep and calming breath and reaches for the book. Today, she knows, it will be finished. The last tale has only a few pages left to share. She has tried to stave away this moment, not wanting the experience to end. She doesn't want this story to be over, but she feels greedy at the thought of wanting more. She turns the paper, reading slowly as to savour every feeling. 3 pages left, now 2, now 1. She could put it back, return it to its clear cocoon and save it for tomorrow. But deep down, she knows that would be cheating. Her eyes linger on the last sentence, drinking in emotions as if they are fine wine. The end is certain and inevitable. The last word trips and fades. She closes the book with sadness, places it almost reverently in her lap. The sea is shining. A million diamonds of bright sunlight shimmer on the water's surface. They twinkle like a galaxy of daytime constellations, a moving jewelry box of light. A movement by the water's edge surprises her. She squints and tries to see beyond the glare. Something slow and soft is coming. A creature, maybe, long-limbed and delicate, ethereal, perhaps. It lifts itself out of the water with a dancer's poise, carefully unfolding itself as it goes, moving with the pulse and ripple of the sea. She watches, enthralled and curious, unafraid. The creature spies her, bows deeply and makes a beeline for her. Its skin is pale and almost blue, dappled with a silver sheen. Its hair is long and mossy green, great snakes of turquoise blended with thin strands of gold. It moves slowly, gliding over sand and rocks as if it merely floats above them. Like a wave, she thinks, a living wave. It reaches her and she stares up in silent awe. The face that looks back at her is so beautiful she can hardly bear it. She has no words that could offer a description. The creature is radiant. It exudes raw emotion, a feeling so powerful and unexpected, and yet one she recognizes well. Love. This oceanic creature embodies love. It holds out a hand towards her, slim wrists, long fingers tipped with beams of light instead of nails. She reaches out her own hand in return. Their palms touch. She is swallowed by a brilliant burst of stars. Her eyes open. The creature is gone. The ocean is calm now, its surface smooth and steady like a mirror. The book in her lap feels heavier, the spine a little thicker than before. She lifts it shakily, flips it open to the last chapter. Confused, she flicks back a page. And another, and yet more. A new story, one she has not read, is waiting for her, as if it had always been there. She reads the first few words and gasps and smiles. She drives to the beach every morning, come rain or wind or shine.
That was An Ocean of Stars, read by the author Tabitha Wood. Okay, time for some music from Upper Hutt's Shindig, King of the Fairies. I'm John McDonald, and you're in the Hutt Zone on Wellington Access Radio 106.1 FM, and that was Shindig, King of the Fairies. Living in the Korokoro bush for over 30 years, it's hard to miss the unwelcome visitors like rats and mice. And one of the volunteer organisations that's been active for as long as I can remember here in Korokoro is the Korokoro Environment Group, KEG. Just up the road from me is one of KEG's more active members, Andre Oliver. And seeing the traps around Korokoro Hill, I thought it would be a good idea to meet up with Andre and find out more on the work he does. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Good to see you.
How are you going?
Yeah, appreciate you coming out here.
No worries.
All right, so we've got a trap just down here. I never knew we had one in there. Mind you, how did you get to it without disappearing down the bank? Whoops.
Yeah, you jump in, but it's just down here, and it's got a customer.
And it's got a customer too. It's been there for a wee while.
Yes, yeah.
Oh, has it what?
A bit stinky, that one.
Is that... Are you able to bring it out so we can talk about it, or is it all secured in? All right, there we go. Well, I never knew that was one right at the top of the drive there. Oh, I thought that was, you were going to take us down to the one down by the corner, because that's one I see all the time. I never knew there was one.
Oh, down there.
Yeah. So your responsibility, what's your main responsibility for KEG?
In recent times, it's been supporting the trapping efforts in our little community that we've got here in Kaukau. The maintenance of some trap lines and advocating for the rest of the community to jump on board and support, either with a backyard trap or to volunteer some time to look after some of the community lines that exist.
So when you say trapping of what?
Mostly in the community we're doing rats and mice. Back in 2018, the initiative started. In Kaukau, the council supplied a whole bunch of Victor traps and some trap boxes. They were donated or just distributed throughout the community for backyard efforts, if you will.
As your role in the trapping, what do you actually do?
So I find myself out with my dog walking one or two lines.
Now, what's a line? What do you mean by a line?
A series of traps.
Okay.
Here on Kaukau Road, on the lower Kaukau Road where we are now, we've got about 10 traps that go all the way down to the car park. Some of them are quite successful. The one that we're right here next to at the top of this driveway is one of the ones that it quite regularly generates generates a removal.
That's probably the hens. That's what I think attract them. Yes. Okay. That's really. How far apart are the traps in this line?
They're probably 400 meters apart, kind of thing. There's no real sense or reason to where they go. They do get moved around if they're not successful, from one side of the road to another, or into a more ratty or successful spot. You would think.
Yeah. Mm. So what's the process? We've got one here. What's the process in actually setting it up?
So the tunnels are the dock standard.
So the tunnels, the wooden surround around
the it, wooden surround. Yep.
Okay.
And so that's fence palings to the dock design. So
who made that?
I did, actually.
You did that?
I did.
Okay.
That
it's
one.
Got the keg.org.nz on it. Bit of advertising for the website.
Yeah. So keg traps. So for Kaukau Environmental Group. Keg traps have got the website spray painted on them with a handy dandy logo. It's got a little kiwi on the top of it. You know, keg.org.nz. The trap has a Victor plastic professional trap in it.
Do you want to look at it?
Yeah.
Thanks.
And
got a wee cage at the front of it.
Yeah. So there's a door at the back of them. To allow the removal of the trap.
Chicken wire stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. And the front has a notch or a hole big enough for a hedgehog or a rat or a stoat to get in. The dock design is to attempt limit bycatch for birds. And so this little trap here is, like I said, it's a plastic Victor Professional. I like this one because you don't have to touch the kill bar. And I use runny or pourable peanut butter. So I just keep it in a jar and I pour it into the little cup that's there. And as I go on my walk with the dog, we'll go and check the traps.
So this looks like quite a lethal metal sort of clasp on that. So it's what the peanut butter attracts them, they go in through there.
The predator will come in through the front of the trap, are looking for the bait, so in this case the peanut butter, and it'll step on the trigger plate and the trap will strike. The traps have all been designed to meet a standard.
That's a pretty quick kill, is it?
I would assume so. Yeah. Mostly, I mean, I've never come across one that's been happening.
You know, effective.
They don't tend to like us humans.
So it's a pretty strong spring there, and you don't have to touch it because I know I've had older ones, and that was always an art form to set it without fingers in the way.
The benefit of this one is, you just hold the back of it, and you don't have to touch the trap at all, and it just all clicks and.
All right, you just pull the whole thing back, and it locks in quite nicely, and it's quite secure because you could drop it down without it pinging off it.
So some of the other traps, you have to get a little bit more involved. And setting them.
Once you've caught them, what do you do with them?
Yeah, that's a really good question. If you want, you can take them home, but I don't do that. I tend to just put them back into the bush and just let the cycle complete.
Return back to nature.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's safe for cats and dogs and birds?
The dock tunnel has been designed to reduce the interference by non-target species and kids and cats and dogs.
It's like a big sort of wooden shoebox size, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
Do they get stolen by people?
It's hard to say, but sometimes you'll find a trap not there. So it could be washed away or... In Karakura we've not secured them, screwing them to anything or tying them down or bolting them to Waratah. It's hard to say.
How effective are they?
In Karakura we've been, this year we've caught 104 rats and mice, hedgehogs. So doing quite well this year with the project. And that's the community of about 42 members in our little 153 hectare.
And how many traps have we got in there?
There's about 113 traps deployed.
So we go for hedgehogs as well. We see hedgehogs as a nuisance.
Yeah, so hedgehogs are an interesting one. It's often commented when people say, oh, you can't kill the hedgehog. But, it is labelled as a pest by the government. So it is a target species as part of the Predator-Free 2050 initiative.
I also use sort of poison baits. How do poison baits compare to these things for effectiveness, do you think?
So the councils will use a poison bait as part of their efforts quite extensively. In Karakara, not just on this road here, we'll see little blue and pink plastic attached to the fence or lamppost down the road. And that's where the council have got their efforts, which are these hockey stick bait stations that they've got installed. Karakara's borders the Belmont Regional Park, which is quite a large environment for, it's a large park, and the council's efforts, the Greater Wellington Regional Council's and the efforts is quite extensive based on their funding. So they've got a lot of traps or bait stations deployed that are not necessarily serviced all the time.
Now, I read on the KEG website about some instructions for setting up these traps, and it talked about hazing of the entry. What's hazing?
Yeah, when you introduce a trap to your backyard or an environment, it'll be new and foreign to the target species, the predators. And so by not just launching into trapping, it's sort of pre-baiting or making it so it's not foreign to them. So that they want to come and have a look-see rather than run away.
So you wouldn't put the peanut butter in to start with then?
Peanut butter, so pre-bait is recommended.
Just wouldn't set the trap.
They come and have a feed and tell their friends and come back. Yep.
How did you first get involved with KEG?
With KEG, so back in 2018 on the flyer that is distributed around into the letterboxes of Karakura by KEG, there was talk about how we would support the initiative that the government had launched with its Predator Free 2050 program. That was the Trap NZ website for our area, and the initial seed donated traps that were given to the community members. So I got involved there.
Why? Why did you want to get involved?
I really, really attracted to the mission statement of Predator Free. In Karakara, we're quite lucky to have quite a diverse bird life. We've got kereru and tui and moorpork that we hear in night or during the day. And so this is an effort that I could help to support, you know, predator free, but also, you know, those birds in our ecosystem. Yeah.
So what's your hut belly connections?
So I've lived in Korokoro for 20 years, schooled in an upper hut. So my family, most of my family live here, yeah.
The predator-free status, how well is the hut doing to sort of achieve that? I mean, I spoke to people, I think it was Nainai several years ago, and they were looking for that. I just wonder how things generally the hut are for that predator-free ideal state.
Well, we've certainly not done as well as Miramar. It's been a very public and social community effort. They've just managed to achieve their eradication of rats and stoats from the Miramar Peninsula. I'm not 100% sure of how well we're doing as a, you know, predator-free status. It's an ongoing initiative. We're continuing in Korokoro to trap, remove predators from our environment, so they're still there. We've seen an increase in possums, for example. Back in, Osprey did an eradication effort into the Belmont Regional Park.
I know when we first came in here 25 years ago, it was overrun with possums. I haven't seen them for a decade easily, if not more.
Yeah, so 2015 was when the Osprey operation was, and that was to support their initiatives around TB. The whole Belmont Regional Park was targeted, not just the Korokoro Valley, and it really paid it.
Made a big difference.
Paid dividends, But they're returning just around the corner here at up on Singers Road. We've been able to trap two possums, which would never have thought. You just don't see them running around like we used to kids, but certainly not roadkill. But they're there. They were severely reduced in numbers, but they've been able to build up their numbers again. Mm. The reason that we want to sort of slow the possums down is the impact they have on the trees and that ecosystem, which then supports the birds. Yeah, slowing the possums down means the birds have a chance.
Move back in. Something to eat, etc.
The ketera are quite important because they're the ones that disperse the seeds. But in Korokoro we've got lots of ketera. We're seeing katari, so the little kingfisher, and we're hearing reports of, or further up in Belmont way, seeing the kaka and the New Zealand falcon, the kaereere. So that's very exciting.
Mm. So what else is KEG doing at the moment, other than the trapping stuff? What else is coming up?
Capital Kiwi, which every Wellingtonian will be quite rapt about, had an audacious goal of reintroducing kiwi to the capital. They've got quite a big area. It's 23,000 hectares, which they've got 4,500 traps on. Since they started, they've been able to release 63 kiwis, which as of August this year.
Mm.
So those kiwis are going to disperse, and so Belmont Regional Park will look really attractive to them. An adult kiwi can stand up to most of the predators. It's just the chicks won't stand up to a rat or a mustelid. Adult kiwis will be interfered with by dogs and cats. So those kiwis are coming towards us. We've got a role to support the predators not going back into the capital kiwi area. Pest-free puke ariki, which is all of the community groups on the borders of Belmont Regional Park, have come together looking to form and support the council's efforts. The council have some responsibilities with what they call a key native ecosystem. So Korokoro Belmont forms one of those, but they don't have a huge amount of funding. You just need to look at the leaks in the road. And so KEG is looking to add its voice and support to pest-free puke ariki and the servicing or maintenance or deploying of mainly bait and traps for possums, ferrets and stoats. The ferrets and stoats to stop them going back into a Capital Kiwis project, so a border defence, and the possums is to support the ecosystem, the trees, for the birds, and then the cycle continues kind of thing for the dispersal of seed.
How much time do you devote to all this? Because you're obviously an expert in it.
I wouldn't say expert. It certainly does take a lot of effort to go and service or walk some trap lines in the area. Can take 4 hours. I have a dog, a beagle, and he likes walking, and we do that twice a day. That helps, amplifying my efforts through trying to encourage other community members to join in or take a series of trap lines or traps and become a team leader for those has sort of been that's been successful.
How have you achieved that?
So through the KEG newsletter or our Facebook or the community's Facebook page, our website. And so if people show an interest, we gleefully help them out and sign them up.
And the best way of getting in contact is how?
Through the KEG website, so keg.org.nz, so the contact us page. Alternatively, the TrapNZ webpage has projects in the Wellington area, and so you can drill down and find and request to join a project and get involved that way.
That is great, and I very much appreciate you dropping by and showing us and catching a rat for us at the same time.
Might bit of a stinky rat.
Yep. I might let you put that back. Those are all my questions. Is there anything else that you wanted to add?
Just to get involved, I think. If you can support having a rat trap in your backyard, if you can think about your cat and your dog and the context of the Kiwis that are coming, they're makara, they're there, which is a first for probably a lot of us, and pretty special tonga.
And that was Korokoro Environment Group trapper guru Andre Oliver. Andre was talking about the pest trapping and native bush advocacy work happening around Korokoro and the Belmont Regional Park. Time for some more music from Upper Hutt's The Drongos. Here's Monkey Business.
We're going to do an American folk song. So you can buy, go and try, you can pay me next week. Too much monkey business.
Too much monkey business.
Too much monkey business for me to get involved with you. I said I found that good looking trying to get me hooked for me to marry, get a home, settle down, write a book.
Too much monkey business. Too much monkey business. Too much monkey business for me.
We'll be right back.
And that's Monkey Business from the band The Drongos. But sadly, that means it's the end of this week's show. Thanks to all my guests tonight, and a big thank you to you for listening to the show and supporting Wellington Access Radio. You can listen again to the show as a podcast on the Hut Zone pages of accessradio.org.nz, where the last 5 shows are available to download and enjoy in your own time. If you have a suggestion of a hut story or piece of poetry or music, then please do message us either on Facebook, John McDonald NZ, or email the team. And our email is thehutzone@outlook.co.nz. You may well have some great Christmas ideas, stories that we can share, or music over the next few weeks. Do join me again next Thursday in the Hut Zone show. Until then, keep safe. And let's go out with some music from King Leo's self-titled album. It's locally produced and accompanied with many Hutt musicians. Here he is with Doggin' Me Around. Naha ora mai rā, stay well.
This program is brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard.